think we can probably start. So, this is a continuation of the Satipatthana Sutta, which I started a fortnight ago. Has everybody got a copy of Satipatthana Sutta? Yeah? Everybody has what they need? Yeah? Okay, good. Yeah? What page it is? It's page 145 in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima 10. You want a copy? Okay. Hugh is checking. Okay, great. Okay, so I just wanted to just to maybe briefly recap on some of the issues I mentioned last time regarding Satipatthana. Just some basic things. One of the problems with the Satipatthana Sutta is that if you read the sutta in isolation, just the sutta itself, that is not necessarily enough to actually understand what Satipatthana is all about. With the suttas, everything is contextual. Everything fits into us into a broader view, which is the whole path of Buddhism. And the same is true of Satipatthana. So to understand the context around Satipatthana, you have to read the suttas very widely and see how Satipatthana is used across the board. And this is if you really want to understand this thing, that's what you have to do. And some of the things that you find out when you do that, one of the first things, which obviously is very important, is that you find out that Satipatthana, the purpose of Satipatthana, is always to take you to samadhi. That's the point of Satipatthana. And you see that again and again on the Noble Eightfold Path. You have sammasati, leads to sammasamadhi. The five faculties, you have sati, or the faculty of sati, leads to the faculty of samadhi. You see in the bhujangas, you start off with sati sambhujanga, and it leads to all the factors of samadhi afterwards, and also many other contexts that is very clear. That is not so obvious when you read the Satipatthana Sutta in isolation, but when you see the context elsewhere, it becomes very clear that that is the purpose. And of course, that is very useful to know why you're doing this, because that means that if your mind is becoming more calm, more peaceful, and you're moving towards samadhi, then the Satipatthana practice is working. You're going in the right direction. So that is, in a sense, a measuring stick, a measuring way of finding out whether what you're doing actually works. But the other thing, which I mentioned last time, was that you see that when you read the short formula of Satipatthana, there's a short formula which is mentioned in sutta after sutta, it always says that one of the adjective that is used there for somebody who's practicing Satipatthana is that he is Satima. Satima means you're mindful. So in other words, to be able to do Satipatthana, you have to be mindful already. Sometimes it is said that by doing Satipatthana is a way of becoming mindful, but not really. You actually have to be mindful even before you start the Satipatthana proper, and only then does Satipatthana work. So the purpose of this is not to become mindful. You have to establish mindfulness first, and then the purpose actually is to attain samadhi or move towards samadhi. That's what this is all about. And a third thing, which I mentioned last time as a general principle, and I think this is important as well, because sometimes people get very confused. How do I practice Satipatthana? There's all these exercises here. What do I do? Do I sit down? Do I walk? Etc., etc. How do I practice contemplation of feelings, for example? And there is very useful to know that in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha said that all you have to do is practice Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And he said, if you practice mindfulness of breathing, you actually fulfill Satipatthana by practicing that. So you complete the whole program of Satipatthana just by watching the breath. That's enough. And that is the only place in the suttas where the Buddha gives an explanation for how to practice Some of these exercises can, it's pretty obvious how you practice them, but other ones it's not so obvious. And this is the only place where the Buddha gives like a one meditation object which takes you through the whole Satipatthana. So those are just some preliminary remarks, and I think they're all I think they're quite useful, because it's sort of stuff which have been bothering me for many years, and sometimes it takes a long time before you come around to see these things for yourself. And one more general principle, and that is the sort of research that has been done on Satipatthana in different traditions, because you find that the Satipatthana Sutta exists in the Chinese tradition, it exists, there are some Sanskrit fragments, it occurs in the Abhidhamma texts. And because of that, it's possible to do comparative studies of the Satipatthana Sutta. And what you find when you do the comparative studies is that it varies a lot how the Satipatthana Sutta is explained across the different traditions. And the way the Satipatthana Sutta is structured, it is structured with like a preamble and a concluding section. And between that, there's like a large number of different exercises, if you like, meditation exercises. And because it is like a block structure, it's a sutta that was very easy to add new things into it, and this, because it has a block structure. And you were never really able to tell from the sutta itself whether something had been added or even subtracted for that matter, because of the block-like nature of how it's built up. And because of that, because of the comparative studies that have been done, it is quite clear that some of these exercises, they occur across all versions of the sutta, whereas other exercises occur only rarely and sometimes only once in all the versions that exist. And from that, you can say with a fair amount of likelihood which ones of these practices are the earliest ones, go all the way back to the Buddha, and which ones are very likely to have been added later on. And that is very useful if you want to decide how you should practice Satipatthana. Is always the best bet is always to go with the earliest stuff, because you can be quite sure that that comes from the Buddha himself. Well, at least it's most likely to come from the Buddha himself. And I then said that the in the first Satipatthana, which is the Satipatthana on the body, the most likely to be the most ancient aspect of this Satipatthana is the contemplation of the body parts, the 31 parts of the body, because that particular exercise occurs across all the different traditions of body contemplation here. And that's basically where I stopped last time. I only got that far. The next one among the body contemplations is the five elements. The five elements also occurs almost across all versions. There's only one, I think, version of the sutta where it doesn't occur. So again, it's quite likely to be fairly quite original here. So that is where we're at then. So I will do it in an unconventional order. I'm not going to follow the order exactly as it is in the sutta. I will do it in the order of what I think is the most likely to be an early part of the sutta. So the elements then, this is on page 148 in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And it goes as follows. Again, because it's one exercise after the other. Again, because a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body, there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. In this way, and this is the concluding section which exists everywhere, in this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body, internally, externally, both internally, externally. Or else, he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, abides contemplating its nature of vanishing, abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else, mindfulness that there is body is simply established in him, to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating a body in the body here. So let me just go through this in a little bit more detail. So the first thing here, it says, again, because a bhikkhu reviews this same body. This same body, this in the Pali is just a way of referring to your own body. That's what it means by this same body. So the person's own body, that's what it means here. However disposed, however placed, or you can say as it stands. And the point of this is simply that this is not an exercise whereby you think of what the body is going to be like after you die or before you were born or whatever. This is an exercise for thinking of what your body is like now. So whatever, however your body is now, this is how you think of the body here. Because it might be easy to think, well, my body, of course, after death is going to disperse into elements. But actually, the point is, the elements are here, right now. It's not something which just happens after you die. And that is the point there. And then you have these four elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. And this was just the ancient way that things were divided up in those days. So this is just a particular way of looking at the body. Of course, you could think of it in terms of the atomic table, whatever it's called, that sort of thing as well. But I think this, probably in many ways, is a much better way of dividing the body up, because you can actually relate to these elements directly. It's not as easy to relate to carbon or oxygen or whatever, but this is, makes more. It's probably more immediate, and it makes sense. So you think of your body in this way. And how do you actually do this exercise in reality here? And well, all you really do is that you remind yourself that the body has this nature here. And if you go to Majjhima number 28, which is the sutta, the greater sutta on the elephant's footprint, that is actually a sutta that describes contemplation of the element in details. So if you want to learn about the contemplation of the elements, it's right there. And the general idea is just to remind yourself that this body, as it is no different from nature outside. Nature outside is exactly equivalent to this body. When the body dies, it falls apart, it rots up, and it goes back to nature again, just like it was before. And you cannot distinguish, after a while, you can't distinguish the body from nature anymore. The body came from, it came from food, that came from the ground, from nutrients in the ground originally. All of this originally also came from the ground. So it came from there, it goes back there. And even right now, it is no different from these things. And the idea here is just that once you start to see that this body is indistinguishable from the nature around it, the purpose, of course, is to gain a sense of dispassion towards the body. You don't feel such strong attachment anymore because you know that it is no more than the ordinary elements around you. But as with so many things in the Buddha's teaching, so many contemplations, it takes time to allow the mind to get used to these ideas. And that's why if you are serious about using the element contemplation, you have to do it again and again and again until it sort of sinks in and it becomes a powerful contemplation. It only becomes powerful with lots of practice, lots of training, because you get into the idea more and more. The mind sort of wakes up to this more and more, until it finally grasps, actually, the body is exactly the same as the material world outside. There is no difference. And at that point, you sort of let go completely, and the body is no more important in a sense. It's not nothing you attach to anymore. So this is the purpose here. And again, as I said last time, none of these exercises are to be repelled by the body. It's just to gain that neutrality where you lose your normal attachment and desire that we have for our body. And as always, we always start with our own body. Our own body is the most important one. That's why it says this same body here. And then you have this simile here about the cow being cut up. So you sort of pull your body apart, just like a cow is pulled apart, and you divide it into these four kind of piles, if you like, the pile of earth element, the water element, the air element, and the fire element, and you see it as those in those aspects. And then comes the summarizing verse, whereby we talk about the contemplation itself. And I spoke about this last time. I might talk about it again very briefly here. And you will notice here the first part here is that you contemplate this body as a body internally. Internally means relating to yourself. This is your body. Externally, you do the same thing with other bodies. And then you have internally and externally. And the idea there is that that is like a universalization. At that point, you universalize all bodies. This is the nature of bodies, full stop. Whether it's yours or anybody else's. And then that part of the contemplation exercise seem is the one which exists across all the different traditions. So this is the one that is most likely to be, again, ancient, this internal, external, both internal and external contemplation. But then you have the aspect of the contemplation here, which is also the abiding, the seeing the nature of arising and seeing the nature of vanishing and seeing the nature of arising and vanishing. And here we're moving more towards the vipassana idea, seeing things as they actually are. So you can see here, in a sense, we're moving, first of all, we're doing the samatha aspect, where we're just getting rid of the lust for the body. Then you're seeing the body arising and vanishing. This is seeing impermanence in the body. So this is the part which leads to insight. And then once you start getting insight, that is where you have the next factor here. Or else, mindful that there is body is simply establishing to the extent necessary. He has here for bare knowledge. But another way of putting this is for limited knowledge and mindfulness. And a limited knowledge here could mean the kind of knowledge, for example, that you get prior to becoming an Aryan, or even maybe to stream entry. Stream entry is a limited knowledge. And then, by continuing with that practice, you come to the last part here. He abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And here you see the full enlightenment. So in this way, you can see the purpose of this paragraph. It shows you, in a way, how all these contemplations here lead you from the very beginning, once mindfulness is established, all the way up to full enlightenment. So this is this inside paragraph gives you that whole span there. But again, whether all that actually was what Satipatthana was meant to be originally is uncertain. And it's quite possible that only the first part, which talks about contemplating internally, externally, and internally and externally, was the most original aspect of this. Which is interesting, because that fits well with the idea that it's supposed to lead towards samadhi. So, having said that, another question which I also talked about briefly last time, and that is the question, well, is this kind of contemplation of the elements, what is that? Is it vipassana or is it samatha? How are we to understand this? Does it really matter whether it's one or the other? Probably not, but just because we talk about these things, it might be good to clarify what we mean by these things. And it is, in a sense, both samatha and vipassana. It is vipassana in the sense that you are seeing the body in more neutral terms. Remember, vipassana, the root meaning of that is just seeing clearly, seeing things clearly. It can be very profound, but it doesn't have to be so profound. Any clarity of seeing is included in this. So because you have less attachment to the body, you have less grasping and holding on to it, you're seeing it more in neutral terms, it means you have greater clarity. So for that reason, it is a part of what we might call vipassana. But also the purpose of this is because you're overcoming attachment, you're also making the body more peaceful, the mind more peaceful. So it also has a samatha aspect. And this is what you see, I think, throughout these exercises, is that they have that dual aspect of both samatha and vipassana. You see this all the way through. And of course, as I mentioned before, mindfulness of breathing is something that fulfill Satipatthana, and of course mindfulness of breathing is watching the breath is a samatha practice, is a calming practice. And then you use that to gain insight into the different aspects that arise in the mind as you watch the breath, as the breath meditation proceeds. So samatha vipassana going hand in hand, and this is how you normally find things in the suttas. Okay, so that is the element meditation. So these two we have seen so far, the 31 parts and the five elements, are the two most important meditations in the body contemplation, as far as I can see here. Then the next one in importance here is probably the charnel ground contemplations. And again, it follows the same theme. It's about gaining a neutral view of the body. This is a much stronger kind of contemplation, and it's probably not that many people who would want to do this. It's not as if you have to, and it's not that important in the suttas. The 31 parts and the elements are much more important in general in the suttas. But anyway, since it's here, we will go through it. And it reads as follows. Again, bhikkhus, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter, a bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. In this way, etc. And then you have the refrain there again, the concluding refrain of insight. Abides contemplating eternally, externally, internally and externally, etc. And then the next aspect here. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, and various kinds of worms. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. And thus he contemplates internally, externally, etc. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together by sinews, or... And this is like each one exercise for the at the time here, where fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together by sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews, disconnected bones scattered in all directions, here a hand bone, here a foot bone, here a shin bone, here a thigh bone, here a hip bone, here a backbone, here a rib bone, here a breastbone, here an arm bone, here, there a shoulder bone, here a neck bone, there a jaw bone, here a tooth, there a skull. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. And again, he contemplates this internally, externally, both internally and externally. And then lastly, again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, bones bleached white, the color of shells, bones heaped up more than a year old, bones rotted and crumbled to dust. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. So this is a very strong, kind of very graphic contemplation. And you can see here how it goes from the body just being dead all the way until the body basically is completely gone, disappeared utterly, and it's just bones crumbled to dust. It's going back to nature. And very soon there will be nothing left at all of that body by which you could have known that there was a person there in the first place. So it's completely destroyed and completely gone. So this is, of course, also a contemplation of impermanence. You cannot hold on to these things. It's going to disappear utterly and completely and never be there again in the eventually. So this, the way to do this sort of contemplation is a bit similar to the elements. A lot of this is up to one's own imagination. It is something you can do while you're walking. You can sort of imagine. You can think about a corpse and think that you are the same. Kind of very profound about doing this. You just keep doing it until it starts to sink in. But I would say, if anybody who wants to do the body contemplation, the five elements might be is often the best one, because it is not as strong or as hard to do, as repulsive, so to speak, as some of these other meditations here. So there you are. So that is the charnel ground contemplation. Everybody happy with that one? Yeah? Yes? Yeah, sometimes they do that. You can actually see nimittas using these kind of meditations. And it's not just kind of the tradition in Thailand, it's also in the suttas as well. There's a sutta in the Yuddha Nikaya where they say, talk about the samadhi nimitta. And in the sutta, samadhi nimitta doesn't mean like a white light in the mind. It means an object that leads to samadhi. That's the actual meaning in the sutta. So it means object of samadhi. And there it is said that this is in the definition of right effort. Definition of right effort is that you are able to hold a good samadhi nimitta, such as, and then it lists the child and ground contemplations. So it is, yeah, it can be used for giving rise to samadhi. And I think what's happening there is that you are reducing the desire for the body so much, and eventually the all kind of desire is taken away, reduced, and then your mind becomes so pure that you actually gain samadhi from that. Yeah, but you have to be careful not for aversion to rise instead, because that's going to sort of not going to work either. Yeah. Yes,
you.
I meant four. Yeah, sorry. It's just that it says section five. It's called section five elements. So I mixed it up. Sorry about that. Four elements. Yeah. Sometimes they have six as well. Yeah. Sometimes they have a space element and consciousness element. But this is about the physical aspect of the body, so it makes more sense to have the four physical aspects. Yeah. You can maybe add space, but it doesn't really do very much. You know. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually true. Actually, in the Chinese version of the sutta, they actually talk about six elements, but it doesn't fit very well. So I think in that case, that the Pali version is probably more likely to be accurate, because this is about body contemplation, not consciousness. Yeah. You have a question? Okay.
some modern commentators as well have said that the charnel ground contemplations would be first because they're so coarse versus, say, the elements. That, you know, that the Goenka approach with body sweeps, that sort of stuff, an easy way to get into that because it's such a coarse level.
Yeah, I think I think it's like with so many things, it depends on your temperament. You know, what is the good contemplation for you? Mm. I think for some people, it might just be too strong in the channel ground. It might be too much. It might give rise to aversion and negativity or whatever. So you have to really figure out what works for you. That is, I think, in the end of the day, the right attitude.
So if you can't go sit in the charnel ground, you shouldn't do this.
Probably not. Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So, but
I shouldn't do this one to start out with.
Well, the one thing I think people often forget is that any satipatthana, we're talking about satipatthana here, any satipatthana should really only be done when mindfulness has been established. So it's already a very high degree of development there, right? So once you have mindfulness, then you can do these things, because then you have a sense of control over your mind. The point is that mindfulness is a faculty and a power, and as a faculty and a power, it means that you have a sense of control, you're in charge of yourself, your mind just doesn't go all over the place. If you try to do this before you have a sense of control over your mind and your body, then you might be in trouble, and you don't know what happens. So before you know it, you are way off the path.
So that leads me to another question. So you were talking about the Bhajangas.
Yeah.
So you had said that, and it is, you know, mindfulness is the third.
Yeah. First.
Sorry, first.
Yeah.
I apologize. Mm. After you have the first three, mindfulness, effort, and investigation. Mm. Then it goes into the three levels of essentially, you could say, tranquility, calm. Mm. So you use the word samatha.
Mm.
Which one of the three? Because the first one is piti, and I can't remember the other two.
First one is piti, then pasadi, then samadhi.
Then samadhi.
And then upekkha.
Yeah. Yes, but you had used the word samatha. So that was why I asked the question. Do you use them interchangeably? Samatha.
It's supposed to lead to samadhi, and of course the leading to samadhi is part of that, is the tranquility that comes in samatha. Well, samatha, I say samadhi, the meaning of the word samadhi is a specific state, because it's defined as one-pointedness. It's only when you reach a specific state that you can be said to have samadhi, whereas samatha is the process of calming, right?
Right. That's what I'm trying to clarify.
Yeah.
So you use samatha, whereas some people use samatha.
No, I mean, maybe. I'm not sure how other people use it, but yeah.
But you're not using samatha to describe one of those three levels of calm.
There are samatha. There are samatha, but the samatha is much broader. Okay, let's move on to the next one. So those are what I think these are really the things which are likely to be the most original part, I think, of body contemplation. Now we're moving on to the things which are more speculative and more uncertain, whether they ever were part of body contemplation. And I think it is quite likely that they were not. And the first one of these is... it doesn't really matter which order we do these ones in. So let's start with the full awareness first of all. So this is paragraph 3 on page 147. So full awareness, the four postures, and mindfulness of breathing, I think are, in my opinion, not as likely to have, actually even unlikely to have been part of the original Satipatthana. So let's have a look at this and see how this goes. And I should maybe start off straight away to say why it is unlikely. The first reason it's unlikely is because full awareness and the other ones here are found in only some versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the second reason is simply that full awareness is usually placed in the scheme of training as prior to Satipatthana. Your full awareness comes first, and then Satipatthana comes afterwards when you see the gradual training. So it's usually an earlier stage in the gradual training. So it makes reasonably good sense, the idea that it's not found in all the Satipatthana Suttas, and also that it seems to be a prior exercise. So let's have a look at the full awareness here. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. And then you have the refrain, it is in this way that he abides contemplating the body externally, internally, internally and externally. So this is, you can see here that mindfulness is not even mentioned in the main thing here. What is mentioned here is full awareness. So what do we mean by full awareness here? This is the word in Pali is sampajanya. Sampajanya is this idea of, there's a wisdom aspect to this. There's a clarity about what you're doing. You understand what you're doing here. And I think the main reason here, and this is sort of confirmed by the commentary, is that you understand the purpose of what you're doing. Sampajanya is a clarity of the purpose of what you're doing. You know that what you're doing is what you want to do. You're doing exactly what you want to do, and it will achieve the purpose that you're trying to achieve. So it is, in a sense, it is purposeful, and you're doing that which will reach that purpose. So the difference here is that if you have no mindfulness, then you may move your body in all kind of random ways without really knowing what you're doing. You may walk backward and forward, or you may do all these kind of things without clarity. But the person with a degree of mindfulness will do these things, will know how they are, what they're doing, where they're looking, where they're going this way, going that way, what they're eating, etc. So it's that clarity about what you're doing that this is about. And this is all quite clear from all of these things. These are just very ordinary things in the ordinary day, all the sort of stuff ordinary activities, basically. And then you come down towards the end here, and this needs a little bit of explanation, is towards the very end. And that is where it talks about acting with full awareness when falling asleep and waking up. Actually, the Pali here doesn't really say falling asleep. It doesn't say waking up. It says sutte and jagarya. And sutte actually means asleep. And jagarya means while awake. So these are the opposites here. So what does it mean in that case? How can you have full awareness while you're asleep? Well, the point is that you have a full awareness in regard to sleep. In other words, it is The way this can be translated in many ways, because the Pali allows for different kind of translations here. So the most natural thing here is that you have full awareness in regard to sleep. In other words, you know how much you should sleep. You should know when you should go to bed, when you should get up, etc. So it's full awareness in regard to sleep. And the same thing, full awareness regarding being awake is the second one here. The reason why it has been translated with falling asleep and waking up is because the author couldn't really make any sense of having full awareness. Not the author, translator couldn't make any sense of full awareness while sleeping. So I think the more correct interpretation, as far as I can see, is full awareness in regard to sleep rather than falling asleep, which this just doesn't mean in the Pali language. So, and then another reason why I think this particular paragraph may be a later thing, not really concerned with Satipatthana, but be concerned with a preliminary exercise leading to Satipatthana. And this you will see now. If you look at this exercise, and then you look at the refrain which comes afterwards, the refrain which comes afterwards says, in this way, hereby is contemplating a body in the body, internally, externally, both internally and externally. Now, so what this is saying is that you should, first of all, internally means you do all these things in relation to yourself, how you walk, how you stretch your limbs, when you speak, when you remain silent. And that makes good sense. You know, you are mindful, you have full awareness regarding your own actions. It makes very good sense. But then it is saying you should do it externally in regard to other people. And personally, I feel that this doesn't fit very well with this exercise here. How can you, how can you have clear awareness regarding other people's, you know, moving their limbs or moving backward and forward, etc.? It doesn't fit. It fits very well with the body contemplation before, because you contemplate the body parts of yourself and others. But here, it doesn't fit very much anymore. And you will see the same thing is true regarding breath contemplation. Breath contemplation is a personal thing. You do it with yourself. You don't do breath contemplation with other people's bodies. And the same thing with the four postures. The four postures is something you understand your own four postures. You don't so much understand the four postures of other people. So again, this to me is another sign which sort of adds up to the idea that this may not actually fit into Satipatthana proper. Just an interesting point for you to think about. It's not really terribly important, but it's nevertheless, I think, it's an interesting point. So that is the full awareness. And then I will move on to the four postures, which essentially is just another, is very similar to the full awareness one. Again, bhikkhus, when walking, a bhikkhu understands, I am walking. When standing, he understands, I am standing. When sitting, he understands, I am sitting. When lying down, he understands, I am lying down. And he understands, however, his body is disposed. And then you have the refrain, contemplates this internally, externally, both internally and externally. So here again, understanding here, I think, is very similar to the full awareness which comes afterwards. I'm not sure what the distinction would be, to be honest. So it's a very similar exercise to the full awareness which comes afterwards. It is not clear to me that there is much distinction worth talking about. Then the last one is the mindfulness of breathing. And an important point here, as I said before, is that mindfulness of breathing, in the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, which is Majjhima 118, and the Panasati Sutta, it is said that mindfulness of breathing fulfills all four Satipatthanas, not just the first one, all four. But here, you find mindfulness of breathing put into the first Satipatthana and not in the other ones. And this is another reason why this may be a late addition, because it limits the application of mindfulness of breathing to one Satipatthana, when really it applies to all four. So that is, I think that is an important point. Anyway, so here it is. I will go through this fairly quickly, because this really belongs under the Anapanasati Sutta for discussion. But since we are here, I'll go through it anyway. So it goes like this. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating a body in the body. Here a bhikkhu, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect and established mindfulness in front of him, ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. So this is the preliminary part of mindfulness of breathing. I will just stop there because just to explain that part first of all. And you will see that one of the interesting things here, it shows you that a person has gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut. And an important point that this actually is, because it shows you that meditation, when it really takes off, when it really becomes deep, it should ideally be done in solitude and not as a group practice. Because it is in solitude that you can actually get the deepest states of meditation. And that is an important point, and it's right there at the very beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. So that is of course true. So forever, anybody who is very serious about meditation, sometimes it can be good to get some solitude in your practice. Then, once you have found that solitude, you sit down. And that again is also important. You sit down. You don't stand or walk or lie down. It is sitting down, which basically is the basic meditation posture. This is what you do if you want to watch the breath. You sit down. Sometimes you hear about people teaching breath meditation while walking or standing or lying down or whatever. It may work, but the Buddha is saying a sitting posture is the right one, which is interesting. Having folded his legs crosswise, again, that is also interesting. I don't know whether that is absolutely necessary. A chair might be, I think a chair is probably perfectly okay, as long as your body is comfortable and nice and stable. And I think for many people in our world, it's probably advisable sometimes to sit on a chair because you're much more comfortable on a chair than sitting with the legs crosswise. But it might be, and I'm not sure about this, it might be that having your legs crosswise has some sort of benefit which sitting on a chair doesn't have. I don't know about that. Maybe not, maybe it does. Then he sets his body erect, and of course the point here is that when you are erect and not slouching, is that you have usually more clarity in the mind. And then mindfulness established in front of him. Ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. And you may have noticed that in many of the exercises I talked about before, they are often imaginative exercises. If you think about the 31 parts of the body, it's like you can see them in the mind's eye. You can dissect them, you can see the body. It's like an imaginative exercise. Same thing with the four elements, the same with the contemplation of the charnel ground contemplations. But here, you're not actually imagining anything. You're really bringing the mind into the here and now, in front of you, right here, right now, in this moment. So this is what is happening. That's what I think the meaning of this thing is. In front of him means just right here, right now. Parimukha is the Pali word, and it's one of those words which everybody's arguing, what does it actually mean? It probably doesn't. I think all it means is right here, right now, in the present moment. And then, ever mindful, he breathes in, ever mindful, he breathes out. Because once your mindfulness is established here, then the breath naturally appears in the mind. It's like when you sit down, you are peaceful, you close your eyes, and your mind is present, you have mindfulness. When you do that, then the breath will fairly automatically be there straight away. You will see the breath when that happens. And then you are mindful as you breathe in and as you breathe out. And then comes the actual exercise. This is what you're actually doing. So breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Just as a skilled turner or his apprentice one making a long turn understands I make a long turn, or making a short turn understands I make a short turn, so too, breathing in long, he understands I'm breathing long, etc., etc., until the last one, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So, the first part of the thing here is just knowing the breath. You know a short breath, you know a long breath. You're able to tell the difference between a short breath and a long breath. And you will notice sometimes you get meditation instructions saying that you should control the breath. You should make it long or you should make it short. But there's nothing here about control here. All the Buddha says is that you are aware whether the breath is short or whether the breath is long. It's just about awareness, not about control. And that is, of course, very important. Control often leads to a sense of tightness. Pure awareness, when it works rightly, is very relaxed and very easy, and you feel very comfortable about it. Then after you have done that, you will see in the next section here, it says, he trains thus, I shall breathe in experience in the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experience in the whole body. And you may have noticed here that there's a slight change here in the way this is phrased. In the first part, it says, he understands. Here it says, he trains. So what is the difference here? The difference is that in the first part, you start off with mindfulness established. Because mindfulness is established, it is natural that you are aware of the breath. So all you have to do is to understand what's happening with the breath. The breath is already there. There's no training involved. It's just a natural process, you're observing the breath. But here, what's happening here is that from now on, you are training yourself to become more and more and more tranquil. And of course, because it is a training, it means that you have to be observant, you have to see what works, what doesn't work, you have to understand things like defilements, when defilements disappear. And all these things, the observation is very much part of deepening your meditation practice. Because as you observe, you start to understand the process. And that's why this is called training, because you are coming down, 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 and you have to actually learn the process here. In the first part, it's just basic observation. And experiencing the whole body, now the whole body here is sabbakaya, and the word kaya is in other places a reference, in this context, reference to the breath. So when it says here experiencing the whole body, I say it means experiencing the whole breath from the beginning to the end. And you will see that when you read the Anapanasati Sutta, it uses exactly the same word, sabbakaya, but it refers to Anapanasati all the way through. And this is what the commentary says, and I think in this place, what the commentary says makes sense. It doesn't refer to the whole physical body. It refers to the whole body of the breath, the entire breath, so to speak. And then, once you experience the whole breath, you can see here is a gradual process going on. First of all you know is that there's a short breath, there's a long breath. Then your awareness sharpens and you're able to see the whole breath in its whole length. So you're becoming more peaceful, more calm, and you're seeing more because of that peace in the mind. And then, when the mind is peaceful enough to see the whole breath, then the last stage here is it trains thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation. And the bodily formation is again a word for the breath. The bodily formation is a bodily formation in the sense that it is tied up with the body. The body can't exist without it. That's what it means. Kaya sankara. Here, sankara probably has the meaning of what is the meaning of sankara in this case? Maybe like a bodily activity. Sometimes sankara can be translated as activity. So it may mean here something which, like as an activity that creates the body or keeps the body, perhaps, in the sense that without the breath, the body wouldn't exist. I'm not 100% sure what it refers to in this context, but something like that. But it's quite established in the sutta that kaya sankara, bodily formation or bodily activity, actually refers to the breath. So that's quite clear that that is meant in this case. So you tranquilize it. Once you see the whole thing, then you start tranquilizing it and calming it down. You can see the step by step here, samatha, samatha, calming, calming, calming here. And then, of course, beyond that, you have to go to the Anapanasati Sutta, and you see the steps that go beyond that and until it takes you all the way to jhana, the Anapanasati practice. And then you have the simile of the turner here. So in other words, the simile of the turner is just a turner who makes a turn and he understands a long turn and a short turn. And it's just, you know, in other words, he's aware of what he's doing in exactly the same way the person who practices mindfulness of breathing is aware of what he or she is doing. So there you are. And again, as I pointed out before, when it comes then to the insight refrain, it is obviously the internal contemplation that really makes sense in this particular case. Okay, so I will move on to, time goes very fast. So let's move on to the contemplation of feelings on page 149. So that is the body contemplation for you. Anybody has any questions about body contemplation before we move on here? John? Yes. The which one? Elements, yeah. Right, yeah. Solid part, exactly. Yeah. You can, what you can do is, in a sense, you can take the list of the 31 parts of the body, the previous exercise, and you can sort of divide it up into the different aspects if you want. Yeah. Have a look at, John, have a look at Majjhima 28, because that gives you a very good description of the elements, etc. Yes? Yeah. It is, but I think usually you would call that like earth element, because it's harder. So it's more like the cavities in the body, like the mouth cavity. That's like air, because it's open, right? And that's kind of the idea of air element in the body here. Yeah. Okay. So contemplation of feeling. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating feelings as feelings? Now, again, I just want to make the point straight away here that the Pali here is Veda, Vedanesu, Vedana, Vedananupassi, which quite literally means feeling contemplation among feelings. That's quite literally the meaning of that. And of course, many people have tried to figure out, what does this actually mean? Why is feeling said twice? Why doesn't it just say contemplation of feeling? Why doesn't it say feeling contemplation among feelings? And the commentary has a lot of to say about this, and it brings it out into this very very detailed analysis of why this is said. But I think that there's two very fairly obvious reasons why it is explained in this way. I did talk about this last time, but I'll mention it briefly again now. And because it was one thing I didn't mention last time. And the one reason, and this is the reason which you find support for from the Anapanasati Sutta, in particular the Chinese Agama version of the Anapanasati Sutta, is that this refers to a feeling among feelings. In other words, you're contemplating a specific feeling or a specific group of feelings among all possible feelings. So it contemplates a feeling among feelings. That makes sense, because when you read the sutta afterwards, it lists up various types of feelings that you can contemplate. So you're contemplating one particular feeling or one group of feelings among all possible feelings. An alternative, and this is, and that is simply that this is the way the Pali is phrased. It's the Pali idiom that you say the word twice rather than once. And you find this again and again in the sutta, that you have this doubling up a word, which sounds very strange in English, but actually it is a common idiom used in the Pali language. And if that is correct, then really it should be translated simply as "he abides contemplating feelings," full stop. And you shouldn't say feelings twice. And I think both of those interpretations I find very plausible and good interpretations. And I find them the most likely to be the correct ones, personally. Yeah. So this is contemplation of feelings. And it goes as follows. Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel in neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. When feeling a worldly feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling here. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling here. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. When feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. When feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. So, these are the different types of feelings listed. And these feelings are listed pretty much exactly the same in all the different versions of the sutta. So this seems to be a fairly original way, a fairly ancient way that this sutta was presented. Now, first of all, they use the opposites worldly and unworldly. I think a better translation would be worldly on the one side, spiritual on the other side. And of course, a spiritual feeling is a feeling that is connected with spiritual progress. So spiritual happiness is like the happiness of samadhi, happiness of jhanas, etc. Whereas a worldly one is the happiness that comes through the five senses. So this is the distinction there, the spiritual and the worldly. And when it says here that I feel a pleasant feeling, he understands I feel a pleasant feeling here. Maybe the first thing I should explain is again, well, how do you actually do this exercise? Does it mean that you sort of walk around every day and you feel feelings and then you understand this is a happy feeling? Or is there something else to it? And I think, again, it is useful to see how this is done. It's much one of the easy ways of understanding this, again, to turn to the Anapanasati Sutta. Because as I said before, the Anapanasati Sutta says that you actually fulfill this contemplation among all four contemplations. You fulfill this by practicing Anapanasati. So how does this work? Well, the way it works is that as your meditation starts to take off, feelings arise in connection with the breath, feelings of happiness, of joy, and these kind of things. And that serves as a basis for your contemplation. So once you come out of that samadhi or that anapanasati, or even while you're in there, because you understand these feelings, because they're there, and certainly afterwards, you have a data to work with. You start to be able to understand what these feelings are about. And this is what the Buddha said in contemplating feelings. The way of contemplating feelings is to do it while you do anapanasati. That is certainly the way it is described in the suttas. There are probably other ways of doing it as well, but that is the one which is specifically described. That makes it easy, because then you have a way of working with this. So then what do we mean then when we say that he understands a pleasant feeling when it arises? Or he says, when feeling a pleasant feeling, he understands that he feels a pleasant feeling. What does that mean? It seems sort of fairly obvious. Now what it means is that as you practice this path and you come to understand feelings, you start to understand pleasant feelings in its whole breadth. Remember that pleasant feelings, worldly pleasant feelings or ordinary pleasant feelings, has an enormous breadth to it. And the more you understand the whole breadth of pleasant feeling, the more insight you have into it, and the more you understand how you should be dealing with this particular thing. You understand what is good and what is bad, etc. So this is what is meant here. And as you practice, your understanding of feelings will change, because it will become more profound. It will become more deeper. There will be feelings that you never saw before because they are so subtle that you will come to understand because your mind is more profound. And the more you understand the subtle feelings, the more you understand the various type of feelings, the bigger is your map of understanding pleasant feeling. And this is what it means here, is that you're broadening your map, you're coming to a better understanding of what this is all about. And not only that, but you're also coming to understand better the gradation of feelings. You understand that there are certain feelings that are more pleasant than other pleasant feelings. It's not as if all pleasant feelings are equally pleasant. There are gradations, and you start to appreciate the more pleasant ones better because your mind is more refined. So you get this big map of pleasant feeling. This is what it's meant here. It doesn't just mean feeling here and now. It means actually going deeper and deeper into this matter until you see the whole picture. And let's say, yes? Not really, because it is classified here. The worldly feeling is classified as a happy feeling which arises as a basis based on the five senses. And the five senses is always a type of feeling that you want to overcome in meditation practice so you can get the pure pleasure of the mind. So there is in the Buddhist meditation, there's a very clear distinction between the happiness from the five senses and the happiness from the mind alone. And that is also the same distinction as the worldly and the spiritual happiness. You start to get the idea if you meditate and you start to become peaceful in meditation. The more peaceful you are, the more clarity you have, particularly when you start to get joy coming up in meditation practice. That joy which you have sometimes, which is not connected to the senses in any way, that sort of joy is like a spiritual feeling here. Sometimes it's a beautiful day, you just go for a walk somewhere and you feel a joy inside of you. You don't really know what it is. It's not really connected to any sensual pleasure. That can be like the beginning of spiritual happiness. Right? Yeah. Whereas the happiness you get from eating good food, that's five senses happiness. Yes? Yes. Sure. Yeah. Coming to that next. Yeah. Yeah. Coming up. Yeah. Yeah. So that is the pleasant feeling. And it's the same thing with the painful feeling as well. The painful feeling, you want to understand it again in all its breadth, in all its width, so you understand what the problems are. And of course, that also helps you to gain insight into dukkha, the nature of dukkha. You understand, the more you understand about painful feeling, the more you understand about dukkha. And then you have the neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And this is just anything which is neither one nor the other. And you will often find that things that you thought were neutral under the microscope of a sharp mind will turn out to be either slightly pleasant or slightly painful, often slightly painful. And you start to divide things up in a more refined way. And then that is the general characterization. Then you come to the distinction between the worldly and the spiritual feelings. And I think we already discussed the pleasant feeling, what is the worldly pleasant feeling and the spiritual pleasant feeling. But then you have, as Annie said, you have the unpleasant feeling. And also for the unpleasant feeling, it is divided up into worldly and spiritual. And of course, the worldly painful feeling is most of our painful feelings are unworldly painful feelings. Are worldly painful feelings. The unworldly painful feeling is actually described in, I think, one place in the suttas. And that is said to be when you think, oh, your heart starts to yearn for liberation. And you say, oh, may I too, get to that liberation one day. And that yearning, which it's like a pain in the heart almost, that is the spiritual painful feeling in the suttas. You're heading in the right direction, but you haven't gotten there yet, so you have this yearning inside of you. Yeah. I think but you're watching the breath, but the experience is so combined, it's almost impossible to distinguish the breath almost from the feeling. At that point, it gets so, and you will definitely notice the feeling here. Yeah, you will notice you will see the feeling is there. So it will have, the feeling will be there while you're watching the breath. You will definitely know what it is, because it's a very powerful thing. It draws you into the present moment. Your mindfulness becomes very sharp. Yeah.
So it's that,
Yeah, that's a little bit later on. But I think at this point, you can still distinguish. You can still see both aspects. You can see the breath. You can see the feeling here. But they are so closely related to each other that it's almost like one experience.
So it's not talking about
contemplation afterwards. I think it's talking about both. Yeah, both aspects. Contemplation afterwards and while you're there. While you're there, it's just getting to know it. And afterwards, you think, that was quite nice. This must be, you know, this is going the right direction. And you start to get a broader understanding here. When you come out afterwards, you will have much more clarity about the pain of ordinary experience, for example, that sort of thing here. So they come together. So definitely afterwards as well, definitely here. Because you don't want to mess up your meditation too much while you're there by thinking about this. Okay. There's always the dangerous, most dangerous questions that come from the right here. Okay, so that, yes, of course. Yeah. The piti here is you know, the way it is defined, the piti is moving towards the spiritual feelings already. But the way it is defined in the usually in the suttas is that the spiritual feeling is only when you get to the first jhana normally. But of course, there is piti prior to that. So you understand, well, what is that? And it's a kind of a slightly mixed feeling, but it's already moving very strongly towards the spiritual, I would say. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you feel the piti in the body. It has an effect on the body. Yeah. But I don't think it doesn't come from the body. It comes from the mind which is at peace, or the mind which has a good quality in it. So there's a mental thing here. But the mental thing affects the body. So it feels like, it can feel very strongly in the body. Like a wavy thing, like something coursing through the body, something like that. That's the early stages, and then it becomes more peaceful afterwards. Yeah. These are good feelings. That means you're going the right way. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and then the last one then is the distinction between the neither painful nor pleasant feeling here. And this is divided up into, again, the worldly and the spiritual. And the spiritual one here is really the fourth jhana. That's where you come to this one. So this is very, very profound stuff. This is the point where you put behind you all pleasant feeling, all painful feeling here. Of any kind, nothing left, and all you have is this equanimity, neutrality. And of course, at that point, the importance of this, and this I think is so hard to understand, is that when you get to that point, you realize for the first time in your life that feeling absolutely nothing at all, just having a neutral feeling, is much better than being happy. This is the first time you see that. Happiness, even the most refined, most powerful happiness that is possible to have in all of samsara, that's the third jhana, highest happiness that is possible. It says so in the sutta. Actually, not feeling happy at all is much better. It's quite mind-blowing, but that is what that's basically what it's saying here. So,
I have a question.
Do you? Yeah, okay.
Other parts of the suttas gives you the impression that this neither pleasant unpleasant.
Yeah.
It's sort of like moha, you know, sort of like confusion.
Mm.
That's the impression you get from other places. Like you're confused about whether it's pleasant or unpleasant.
Yeah.
You know, you're deluded.
Yeah.
But now you're talking about something that's really quite profound.
Yeah.
So why isn't the word upekha used?
Well,
or if you're going to interpret it as being
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, I think, is a sutta. I think it's Majjhima 44 or something, where it talks about different types of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Yeah. And it says, I think it says in there that when you understand the feeling, when you don't understand it, then this feeling is unpleasant. When you understand it, it's pleasant. And I think most people, they don't understand, they don't see this neither painful nor pleasant feeling clearly because the mind is so running around doing all kind of things. So when you don't understand it, when you don't have clarity about it, it's painful. But here in the fourth jhana, you definitely have clarity about this feeling. For the first time, your mind is absolutely clear. So in this case, it is a happy, happy feeling. Yeah. I think that's what it says in Majjhima 43 or something like that. Yeah. Something to that extent. And what is the difference between upeka and this feeling here? Right? Is that what you're asking as well?
Oh, no, I know that. I suppose really my question is, what's the Pali, you see?
Pali is...
Is the Pali the same in all of those cases of describing what is, is neither pleasant nor unpleasant?
Yeah.
It is the same.
Adukka masukka vedana. Neither pain nor pleasure.
Because you see in the definition of third and fourth John, it talks about, right?
Yeah, it's in the third and fourth dhamma. Yeah. Yes. Okay. This is taking a long time. I think what we need to do is to probably to call it a day there. Does that make sense? People are getting quite tired there. It gets quite long here. And then continue maybe. I won't be here in a fortnight, but maybe in a month's time or something. Yeah. Is that okay with everybody? Yeah, because otherwise I think you're going to lose the plot. It gets too long here. Any further questions before we... One thing I should say about contemplation of feelings before we stop is that these feelings are really understood when you go beyond them. So, for example, the worldly feelings, the feeling of the five senses, are only really fully appreciated when you go completely beyond them into deep samadhi. Then when you look back, do you understand these things? And the same thing with all the worldly feelings. It's when you go beyond the worldly realm that you understand the worldly feelings. And the same thing with happiness and pleasure. You can only really fully understand the mental happiness, the happiness of the samadhi, when you get to the fourth jhana and you look back and you completely transcended it. That's when you have the full understanding. So full understanding in Buddhism usually means you have gone beyond it. When you've gone beyond it, that's when the understanding fully arises. In the meantime, you're approximating, going closer and closer and closer until one day, bang, you have this exceptional experience. So this is also part of this understanding of feeling as you go through it. Okay, anything else? John? The unworldly painful feeling is the feeling, just like all these other monks and nuns who have achieved the highest state. You know, may I also one day achieve this highest goal? I think it's in here somewhere. If I can find it, I'm not sure if how easy it is to find. To be honest, it is in one of the suttas here somewhere. I think I'm probably pushing my luck trying to find it here and now. But it's something with those words, you know, it's that kind of yearning for liberation that you have. And that yearning is a kind of like a heartache, maybe, or something like that, you know. It depends what you mean by wholesome. It is painful, so something you want to go beyond. And the way you go beyond it is by getting the... spiritual happy feeling, right? Of samadhi, that's how you go beyond it. But it's good in the sense that it pushes you in the right direction. Huh? So nothing, things that aren't usually clear cut. Sorry? It's a prod, yeah. Because you have understood something, right? You really have this yearning, you have understood something profound. So, yeah. Don't know. That's the one mentioned in the suttas. But similar feelings, I guess, would be I guess you can think of similar scenarios probably where you might be able to think of something. But yeah. Well, it is. That's how it is divided up in a certain sutta. It's divided up into 108. But there is one sutta, an interesting sutta, where there's two monks. I think it is. They're arguing. One says, "Oh no, there's." So many types of feeling. No, there's so many types of feeling here. And then the Buddha says, this is not the right kind of argument. It doesn't make any sense because it depends how you divide it up. You can divide it up into two types of feeling, three types of feeling, five types of feeling, six types of feeling, 18 types of feeling. It just depends on how you classify it. It's just a method of analysis, just a way to help you understand these things. But there, you could probably divide it up into a million types if you really wanted to, depending on how you go about it. This was the standard way the Buddha would divide it up.
Could I just add something? experience in meditation of having at moments, having at periods during meditation when the mind's wisdom is such that you get greater levels of clarity and can see things fleetingly, that then, right, it's not always present.
Right, yeah.
You know how they say that there's this expression that says that you will, when you have the wisdom, then you will see the Nibbana.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
If it comes fleetingly, and then more and more frequently is one school of thought.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
What you're saying
is that you, as you meditate, sometimes you have a fleeting experience where you understand, for example, the dukkha of things,
exactly.
And then you think, "Oh, I've got to get out of this because this is terrible." Yeah,
Meditation, and there's the dukkha.
Right? And that is, it is in a sense an aspect of nibbida, right? Of repulsion for the world because you understand the dukkha, and that repulsion might sort of push you on the path, and you might think, "Oh no, I got to get out of this." And that's what's happening. Yeah, that's I think that's a good point. Yeah, yeah, makes good sense to me. Yeah. So yeah, okay, let's pay homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.